Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The 80th annual one-shot antelope hunt is canceled due to the pandemic. Critics hope organizers will take the opportunity to retire racist elements of the event.
I don't know who ever thought of that, but to me it's totally inappropriate, and I think it's just a mockery of who we are as people.
Kids are back in schools, and districts around the state are taking different approaches to how they're sharing positive COVID-19 cases with the public.
We think it's important to be very transparent with what's going on.
The Fort Belknap Reservation has a successful history returning native species to their habitats, and they've recently started their newest reintroduction effort.
It'll be one of the most intact short grass prairie ecosystems in the entire country now.
It's all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. This weekend would have marked the 80th annual one-shot antelope hunt. Organizers say they called it off because of the pandemic. But the cancellation also comes after a summer of intense criticism for the event and those who've participated. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr reports.
Every September, 24 men gather in Lander to see who can down an antelope with a single bullet. In this 2012 clip, courtesy of Wyoming PBS, one hunter takes his shot. The antelope staggers.
He's hit, I think.
He's hit.
And then topples over.
He's down.
The one-shot antelope hunt is put on to benefit a nonprofit called Water for Wildlife. The men who are invited to participate, and they are all men, wield a lot of collective power. Past shooters include former Vice President Dick Cheney, Donald Trump Jr., and governors from 31 states. They spend a good portion of the weekend playing Indian.
Good evening and welcome to The Legend of the Hunt.
On Friday night, an Eastern Shoshone elder gives the hunters Indian names and makes them, quote, blood brothers of the tribe.
While the white man has a gun that speaks thunder and kills game at distances far beyond the flight of the truest arrow, all of these men have learned to love and respect their red brothers and are anxious to help the Indians. So that
I don't know who ever thought of that, but to me it's totally inappropriate, and I think it's just a mockery of who we are as people.
That's Karen Snyder, vice chairwoman of the Eastern Shoshone tribe. She wants to set the record straight.
The Shoshone tribe, we do not sponsor, we do not sanction, nor do we participate as a tribe collectively in that event.
Instead, a few individual Shoshone families participate.
And what has happened throughout the years is that they have basically just handed down practices that I completely disagree with.
Practices like allowing the winners of the hunt to wear a war bonnet and making the losers dress up like Native women as pennants. Earlier this summer, photos surfaced of former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper wearing both costumes. That didn't stop him from winning the Democratic nomination for a U.S. Senate seat in the state. But he told Colorado Public Radio that he regrets wearing a Native woman's scarf and shawl.
It's certainly nothing that I would, it's nothing that I would ever do again.
The war bonnet, he said, is a different story.
This was a, long-standing traditional hunt. The headdress was placed on my head by the hunt chief. Had I not allowed him to do that, he would have been offended.
But the hunt chief himself says that's not the case.
That'd be his choice. We wouldn't push it. It's a person's choice if he wants to wear it.
Arlen Shoyo says he's not really a hunt chief. In fact, all the ceremonial aspects of the one-shot antelope hunt are pretend. But he's been playing the role for years, and he says the recent criticism is overblown.
If I felt that it was a mockery of our tradition or whatever, I would certainly say something about it, but it's all in good fun.
He gets compensated, though he wouldn't share how much. Plus, he says it's kind of fun to mess with a bunch of rich white guys. Still, it's important to note that Shoyo and the handful of others who are paid to perform make up just a tiny fraction of Shoshone people. Rose Ann Abramson, who's Shoshone Bannock, had never even heard of the one-shot antelope hunt until this summer, When she learned about the fake ceremonies and costumes, she was horrified.
Oh my goodness. In a way, I see it as degrading, but it's also setting a mindset. It sets this crazy mindset of superiority.
And she fears that those powerful men will bring that mindset to their interactions with Native people and nations. Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon competed in last year's hunt, but had another commitment and left before the dress-up component. He says the cancellation of this year's event is an opportunity.
Really to blend what is a longtime event with more cultural sensitivity.
So far, the Hunt's Board of Directors hasn't announced any plans to do that. Eastern Shoshone Vice Chairwoman Snyder says the men who've participated need to take responsibility for the harm they've done, including Senate hopeful John Hickenlooper.
I would think that he could say that he recognizes that it was a misstep and apologize, because he now understands who we are as people, how we treat our women, and the honor and privilege of wearing a war bonnet.
Hickenlooper's campaign declined an interview request from Wyoming Public Radio. Leaders from the one-shot antelope hunt didn't respond to one. According to Snyder, neither has reached out to try and make things right with the Eastern Shoshone tribe. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Savannah Marr.
During the COVID-19 pandemic, many have turned to the great outdoors in an effort to get out of their house but still stay away from people. And with more people out of work, it also helps to be able to fill the freezer. Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Engel has more about the state of hunting during a pandemic.
For some, stocking up on food during the pandemic means buying extra meat. For others, it means buying a hunting license and heading into the field. For Tylan Smith, it's her first time going hunting.
The idea of meat to me is far more appealing than having a mount or a trophy or anything like that. That is a huge aspect that I would like to do every year. If my freezer starts getting empty, it would be nice to have it full and also have the satisfaction of you killed this animal and that you processed it and that you didn't waste it and it was all out of your own skill.
Smith has always been interested in the outdoors and tagged along on numerous hunts as a kid. This was the first year she applied for a hunting tag, and she drew for two antelope and a deer. Mason Lee is a new hunter too, but she didn't draw for a tag this year. She was a vegetarian for 10 years, but recently started eating meat again. Hunting is a way she plans to ethically provide her own meat. Lee says an added bonus during the pandemic is that hunting is inherently a distanced activity.
When you're out hunting, and if you go by yourself or with someone in your family, you're in the middle of the woods, so you don't have to worry about social distancing.
The Wyoming Game and Fish Department is expecting the hunting season to continue without any disruptions from the pandemic. And according to their spokesperson, Sarah Dorenzo, most license applications seem to reflect that expectation.
There's an increasing interest in hunting in Wyoming. We see more and more applications each year, and this year was the same. There's still really high demand for the high-quality wildlife that we have in the state. And so the only applications that we saw decrease were with non-resident elk.
But the pandemic didn't dissuade residents from applying. In fact, according to Wyoming Game and Fish, all resident applications increased, some species up to 20%. But a lot of hunters were unsure if they would be hunting at all this fall. The application period for most big game hunting licenses opened in January, before the pandemic hit, and remained open through the worst of the shutdowns, closing June 1st. But non-resident elk applications were due by January 31st, before those hunters knew the extent of the situation. Both resident and non-resident hunters were able to withdraw by early summer, with more knowledge of the pandemic. But they still didn't know their draw results.
The period to withdraw that license, the deadline, was right in the middle of COVID-19 pandemic. And so lots of people were trying to decide what they want to do with the fall, what was happening then. And so we think that the reason we saw a slight decrease in those non-resident applications for elk is because the uncertainty of the fall was still up in the air at that time.
Pew Research Center says non-resident hunters bring nearly $3 billion into the state each year, and elk are one of the more expensive animals to hunt. Hunters support businesses like restaurants, hotels, gas stations, and outfitters. Fewer hunters can affect Wyoming's economy. One reason the number of out-of-state applications dropped could be because they use a preference point system to determine who successfully draws. Randy Morrison owns Thunder Ridge Outfitters in Casper with his father. He says the combination of the point system and the timing of the withdrawal window had a huge effect on their booking numbers. they average up to 35 bookings a year. This year, they have 11.
We had almost everybody back out of the draw.
All out-of-state licenses require preference points to successfully draw. When you apply for a license, you can also buy a point for that species. Once you've accumulated enough, you can apply for more limited licenses, like in certain elk areas, and increase your odds of drawing.
These guys get 10 or 12 preference points, so effectively 10 years or more of trying to get a tag, building their points, and if they draw a tag and then their state closes them down, they're going to lose 10 years of preference points and never get them back.
If you successfully draw a tag, you lose all of your points and have to start over from zero. And that's even if there are pandemic restrictions in place that prevent you from using that license.
They're scared that they're going to lose those points and not get to hunt.
Some people applied anyway, choosing to chance the fall pandemic situation and their points.
Most of our people that are coming did draw elk, and they just weren't worried about it. They were willing to take the risk and said, heck with it, we're going to make this happen no matter what. So they went ahead and applied, and a few of them drew.
It was easier for residents to decide to go hunting this year because they don't have to deal with the point system as much. Unfortunately, residents don't tend to use outfitters. But the outfitting business isn't Morrison's only source of income. With less bookings, he's looking forward to a full hunting season and a full freezer for himself.
I have a unique situation where I had another business that allowed me to kind of recoup that difference, I guess. But I drew a bunch of really good tags myself this year. I have no idea what I did right to draw everything I drew. So it's actually going to work out great that I don't have that many clients. I've got lots of time to do what I drew.
The start of an unusual hunting season began in mid-August. Many are excited to get outside and away from people in the middle of this pandemic. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Ivy Engel.
When we come back, we will look at a modern-day Western water dispute and discuss the new season of the Modern West podcast. This is Open Spaces.
This season on the Modern West, the rural American West is struggling. Jobs disappearing, schools closing.
No matter where I went, there's always in my heart was I had a hometown, and it was still there waiting for me to come back.
It's the great ghost towning of America. But small towns are fighting back. A new season of the Modern West starts September 16th. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Many communities in the West are growing, and in some places, that's putting pressure on already scarce water supplies. That's the case in northern Colorado, where a proposed set of reservoirs promises to allow small suburbs to keep getting bigger. But as Luke Runyon reports, it's also stirred up a familiar debate over how the West grows and whether water should be a limiting factor.
Cars and trucks are whizzing past here along Highway 287 between Fort Collins, Colorado and Laramie, Wyoming. This valley that the highway runs through is narrow, covered in shrubs with rocky walls on both sides, sort of a geologic bathtub shape. This is the site for the Northern Integrated Supply Project's biggest reservoir. And if it ends up being built, I'd be standing more than 200 feet underwater here. Better known by its acronym, NISP would create one of the West's biggest reservoirs in the past couple decades. And with a more than $1 billion price tag, a project of this size has those who live nearby concerned. If the proposed Glade Reservoir is built, Lori Nielsen would have almost lakefront property.
Our house is situated far enough away, our property value would probably increase, you know, ironically, with a reservoir of this nature.
But in the sprawling network of proposed water pipelines and the new dam down the road, Nielsen sees a bigger force at play: population growth.
Building reservoirs, reservoir development, is something that we used to do 50 years ago or 100 years ago. We have so many more tools that are at our disposal now to plan for that growth that I feel like are being ignored.
People still want to come to Colorado.
Brad Wind is the general manager of Northern Water, the quasi-governmental agency that moves water through tunnels, canals, and reservoirs across a broad swath of northern Colorado.
And shutting off the water tap is probably not the means to slow the growth down.
Wind's district is pushing for NISP on behalf of 15 other water providers, mostly small suburbs with ambitions to grow.
As they bring on the anticipated growth that they're foreseeing, there is just not, in our minds, another go-to besides drying up agriculture within their vicinity.
For decades, Colorado's cities have been buying up agricultural water rights to keep up with demand. NISP, he says, is meant to curb that trend. That's the case for Erie, a rapidly growing town with an easy commute to Boulder and North Denver. It would be the largest recipient of the new project's water.
And there is no doubt that Erie needs this water to meet its build-out demands.
Paul Zylis is the town's water attorney. He was brought on in the late 80s when Erie had only one small reservoir for its drinking supply.
And it went dry. And they literally were going to have to truck water, and luckily we found a temporary solution, and from there we've moved forward.
With limited water supplies, Zylis says home prices are already rising due to the high cost of coming up with new water, either buying it from farmers or building big new buckets.
The bottom line is that if NISP doesn't get built, every one of the 15 participants are going to be on their own competing for scarce water.
And that, he says, will force suburban cities and developers to scour the countryside for farmers wanting to sell their water rights.
Yeah.
The project would tap into the Poudre River and fill its reservoir with its turbulent spring flows. That's the same time kayakers flock to its newly built whitewater park in downtown Fort Collins.
It's already pretty affected, but NISP would really increase that effect to almost there being no flooding or, you know, natural kind of rise in the river due to the snowmelt.
Evan Stafford is with American Whitewater, a river recreation advocacy group. He says a Western River's rise and fall is important, not just for recreators, but for its ecological health. High spring flows flush sediment downstream and are critical for fish and bird habitat. Without them?
It would be hard, I think, to really call it a river at that point. It becomes a drainage ditch.
Northern Water says when the project is built, they'll actually end up adding water to the river in times of low flow, and diverting the high flows are a necessary trade-off. The project still needs one more federal approval before it's considered fully permitted, and that could come as early as this fall. I'm Luke Runyon in Fort Collins, Colorado.
This story is part of an ongoing effort at Water Coverage in the West, produced in partnership with KUNC in Northern Colorado, with support from the Walton Family Foundation. Wyoming Public Radio's podcast, The Modern West, has been gearing up for a new season, but they're doing something quite different this time around. Instead of a lot of separate stories, they're going to tell one big story over the course of 11 episodes. The podcast host, Melody Edwards, joins us now to discuss this. And Melody, first off, thank you for joining us. You know, season two is called Ghost Towning. Tell me what that's all about.
Yeah, so ghost towning, it refers to this phenomena that we've seen since the settling of the West, where towns sprout up and then for some reason they just start to decline. We have this really romanticized idea about ghost towns, that they're sort of like our Roman ruins or something. But we can actually learn something from these old towns. I talked to Samuel Western, the author of Pushed Off the Mountain, Sold Down the River, and he's an economics historian. He gave me a really good definition of what qualifies as a ghost town.
You need a post office and a school, usually. And when you lose those two entities, I think you probably could be called a ghost town.
And yeah, the elementary school that I went to in Walden, Colorado, it's now boarded up, actually. All the kids in the whole district go to school in one building, the old high school. The post office there is fine, but my hometown is sort of fighting for survival at this point.
It sounds like this season is much more personal for you.
Yeah, it really is. My family has lived in Walden off and on my whole life, My mom was the editor of the local newspaper for a while. My whole family has owned several businesses there over the years. My parents still live there, but recently my mom started having some serious health issues, but there's no hospital in the county, so she ended up taking several scary ambulance rides and even got flight for life once over these high mountain passes just to get help.
That is just embarrassing, really, because it's a small community. The people that are doing the ambulance service are people I know really well, you know, and here they come into the house, you know, and start listening to my heart and cutting off my shirt, and which I have still never forgiven Jim for doing that. It was my favorite T-shirt.
Yeah, and we're really not sure what's wrong with her still. So then she started thinking about moving to Laramie, and that's where I live, about an hour away, so that she could be closer to a hospital. But my dad hates big cities. I know it's crazy. Laramie is a big city to him. But yeah, my mom is now mostly living in Laramie, and my dad is mostly still living in Walden, and they're just trying to make that work. You know, my mom adopted some Labradoodle puppies to keep him company. So yeah, this is the kind of hard decisions that people in small towns make all the time as their resources start to dry up.
So I guess the basic question is, what are some of the reasons that small towns are shrinking so fast in the West?
Well, you know, everybody blames the boom and bust economy, and that is a real problem. And it's actually becoming more and more of a problem, you know, almost as bad as the busts of those old Wild West gold rush towns, you know. But there was a big fracking boom around my hometown in Walden, but it just recently crashed, like big time. My dad worked in the oil field as a roughneck, and I talked to some of his buddies about some of the reasons that it went belly up.
From Oklahoma came out and bought the...
The oil field or what?
Bought the oil field.
Yeah.
Going into bankruptcy, telling everybody what a great company they are. And their friggin' CEO gets a $18 million bonus for his expert guidance and leadership through the bankruptcy process.
And that feeling of the gap between the haves and the have-nots, it's really widening. And that's another cause for some of these towns and why they're struggling so much. Around the American West, a lot of family ranches are getting bought up by the ultra-wealthy. And that's really undermined a traditional way of life. In my own hometown, a rich businessman, a guy named Jim Moore, bought up a good portion of our main street with plans to fix it up, but then got sidetracked and ended up abandoning that project for like a decade and a half. And so I interviewed him about why that was.
Actually, what has happened in that same period of time, more buildings went vacant and more buildings deteriorated. So I certainly didn't make a positive contribution during that time period, but I'm going to make up for it now.
But in the podcast, we're also going to be taking a historical look at some of the West's ghost towns and how race has actually played a big role in why these towns died. And we're also going to look at how immigrants nowadays could actually be helping some of these towns survive now by doing a lot of the jobs that are necessary to keep a town from collapsing.
You know, listening, this all sounds like a real evolution for the Modern West podcast. Now, I know you guys had some help developing this season. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, we really did. The Modern West was lucky enough to be one of six podcasts chosen by PRX to participate in a year of intensive training. They gave Wyoming Public Media some generous funds, and we all spent several weeks in Boston at the podcast garage right down by Harvard. It gave us the confidence to go a lot bigger with our storytelling and to take a lot more creative risks with the sound of it, too. It was so fun. I recently got to dig up a bunch of sound effects to narrate a ghost town gunfight.
Boyer and Redmond shot Weber and Dean from ambush, killing them instantly. Barney Day, an old Indian fighter, saw the shooting and rushed towards Sheriff Boyer in an attempt to prevent further bloodshed.
I totally love that stuff, and I think it makes for a captivating listening experience.
That's Modern West podcast host Melody Edwards. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Bob.
should mention the first episode of the Ghost Towning series comes out on September 16th. Stay with us as we look at how schools are dealing with COVID-19, and we will look into the pause at the University of Wyoming. This is Open Spaces.
Five years ago, we asked ourselves, what if we made a show that sounds like a storyteller speaking to you, that strips everything down to what happens next? What if we made a podcast about where humans and our habitat meet?
Here's mysteries you didn't even realize were still out there.
I'm Erin Jones. 5 years worth of human nature is waiting for you under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. As K-12 schools have students back in class, the challenge is how to keep everyone safe from COVID-19. But a question exists. Will the public know how they're doing? Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler has more on this collaborative reporting with the Casper Star Tribune.
In Cody, Park County School District No. 6 Superintendent Peggy Monteith says with all the uncertainty going on in the world, she was just happy to see kids climb onto a school bus.
I stopped behind a bus with their red lights on and watched these little guys get on the bus with their masks. And I was an emotional mess by the time I got to the school because I was so happy to see them back on buses, but also so sad that they had to get on buses in masks. And what a world. It's just turned upside down.
In Wyoming's 48 school districts, students are back to school in one way or another, whether that's remotely, like all the schools on the Wind River Reservation, or back in the classroom. But with bringing kids and staff together, there are concerns about the spread of COVID-19. That's why each district had to put together what the Wyoming Department of Education is calling Smart Start Guidelines, or plans to reopen schools with safety measures and contingencies in case of a spike in the virus. State Health Officer Dr. Alexia Harris says each plan is specific to each district, but schools have to have a couple of components factored in.
The first one is making sure that if students and staff are sick, that they are staying home. And so schools have done that in different ways, many involving asking the parent to check their students before the school day and keep them home and contact their health care provider if they have any symptoms that could be consistent with COVID-19. And that's a really important step.
Harris says other important measures include physical distancing, face coverings, and frequent hand washing. But as schools have started to reopen, a handful of positive cases have popped up. So far, cases have been identified in schools in at least 6 counties. The Wyoming Department of Health says there have been about 30 cases in schools over the past 2.5 weeks. But each district has to come up with its own plans for how to handle positive COVID-19 cases, including whether or not they want to tell you about it. Harris says the Department of Health has left public notification up to districts, like they've done with long-term health facilities and other sectors.
We believe that much of that information is better shared locally by districts or local health departments in a timely manner.
And if there is a positive case, health officials will get in touch with anyone determined to be a close contact. State Superintendent of Public Instruction Jillian Baylow says when the Wyoming Department of Education was reviewing each district's reopening plans, communication strategies were a part of that.
We went over that with a fine-tooth comb, you know, looking at everything from were they meeting the health and safety protocols as lined out in state health orders? Did they have a mechanism for communicating and collaborating with their county health officer, and how was that being communicated to the public?
The decision some are making is not to announce the cases to the school community or to the public. Campbell County is one of those districts. Local public health officials say they will notify those who've come in contact with a positive COVID-19 case. They also say for parents and students in Campbell County, no news is good news. In Cody, they're taking a different approach. Superintendent Peg Monteith says as of September 9th, there are 5 cases in the school district, and they are telling the community about those cases.
We think it's important to be very transparent with what's going on. If we're not, and that information gets out in a variety of ways that may not all be entirely accurate, folks are going to fill in the blanks with their own stories, and that can create some real challenges for us.
Monteith says they've worked out a plan with the Park County Public Health Department, principals, and school nurses to make sure that students' privacy is still protected while getting that information out. She adds she'd like to know about the amount of cases occurring in schools statewide.
It also helps us to know if, in fact, what we're doing is making a difference, I think. I would love to know how our plan stacks up against, you know, another district our size, and are we seeing the same kind of cases, or is it different? Are there some things that we could be doing differently to make this better?
State Superintendent Jillian Bailo says while the future is uncertain, they'll be ready to adapt.
I've become fond lately of quoting Eisenhower after Normandy, and he noted that plans are worthless, but planning is invaluable. And that's really what we're seeing.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler.
Due to multiple outbreaks of coronavirus in the University of Wyoming student population, the campus shut down and classes were provided online. As the university determines whether students can be in the classroom, Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor reports they're also considering whether to punish some students for disregarding health guidelines.
University of Wyoming officials had high hopes for phasing students back into the classroom, but those hopes were dashed when large numbers of positive COVID-19 tests started coming in. As of Thursday, the university had 66 active cases. 63 of those were students, 50 of whom live off-campus. Off-campus parties hosted and attended by UW students have contributed to several of the confirmed infections and placed well over 100 students in quarantine. Since classes are online, the university has offered students the chance to withdraw and receive a full refund on their tuition. But many students, including freshman Ethan Alanyan, are going to stay.
Honestly, if they had announced this during the summer, I probably would have ended up taking a gap year because that is what I had agreed with my parents. I mean, I've already started classes. I'm probably going to stick it out and just see how it goes.
Alanyan says it's disappointing that other students have acted so recklessly, especially since he's been so careful.
It sucks. I mean, I'll be straightforward. I mean, it's horrible because we as students can definitely see what the cause is because we live in dorms and we live right across the frat houses and we always see them, you know, hosting parties and stuff. Like, it is safer to be in the dorms.
The university says many of the cases were tied to off-campus parties attended by students and members of the university's Greek life community. Health authorities say that those that attended were not following mandated health guidelines. That information hurts for Alanyan, who has been reprimanded for seeing hallmates in his dorm floor's common room, and even for playing Ultimate Frisbee outside while unmasked.
I wish they would crack more down on the actual cause instead of really getting strict with, you know, just us, you know, we're being safe.
Taryn Parody also thought she was being safe, until she tested positive.
Before getting it, I was like, people aren't taking it seriously. And then I realized I wasn't taking it seriously because I still was kind of hanging out with some of my friends just because I hadn't seen them for a super long time.
Parody hosted several friends at her apartment a few times during the first weeks of the semester. As an off-campus student, she says it was easy to disregard the warnings and guidance coming from the university.
And it's not something that, like, I intentionally did. I wasn't going out and thinking, oh, I hope the university doesn't hear about this. It was more along the lines of, oh, I just haven't seen these people in months. It'd be nice to catch up. And so I could have taken the warnings more serious than I did. And that is my fault.
Parody says she hasn't heard anything about academic consequences for violating the student code of conduct. But the university could crack down on students for hosting parties, according to Ryan O'Neill, the university's dean of students. And the consequences could be very serious.
The potential outcome of any student found responsible for hosting a large social gathering could include up to suspension or dismissal from the university.
But that's not a foregone conclusion.
Obviously, we would want to consider all of the mitigating factors. You know, context is important, but it has been determined that that level of sanction or conduct outcome would be appropriate should a student be found responsible.
The Student Code of Conduct outlines how UW responds to reported incidents. They'll consider evidence, conduct an investigation, and eventually meet with the student. If the student accepts responsibility, the university will work with them on improving their decision-making. There could also be a hearing that could lead to sanctions, and possibly expulsion. O'Neill doesn't want to punish anyone. She just wants them to act responsibly.
So I would beseech students to be reflecting on their decision-making.
This problem is occurring in universities across the country, and it comes as no surprise to public health experts. UW public health researcher Christine Porter predicted this outcome right before the semester began.
The struggle is going to be that, on average, people in the age group of the average college student generally are making decisions based on a feeling of invincibility, possibly being under the influence, and prioritizing, understandably, you know, the social, fun, engagement part of being in college.
Porter added it would only take a few students acting in this predictable way to shut down the institution.
Even if 80% of the students do the right thing or 90% of the students do the right thing, it would only take, you know, a small group, which is to lead to super spreading events, and that seems very likely based on everything we know and have seen so far.
O'Neill says she wants to work with students to continually improve the university's response.
But if we don't have compliance with the expectations, if we don't have everybody bought in and understanding that, you know, their individual choices are steering the direction of what the semester is going to look like, I feel like we're going to be limited moving forward.
University President Ed Seidel would like to reopen the campus, but he'll only do it if they can be sure the students will be safe. If not, the rest of the semester will be taught online. For Wyoming Public Radio, this is Jeff Victor.
Changing gears. Libby Montana was already living with an invisible enemy that attacked your lungs long before COVID-19 reached our shores. For the past century, asbestos has killed hundreds in this small town at least, and our Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie reports that experience informs how it's reacting today.
Frank Phelan has been slowly building his dream house near Libby, Montana for the past 15 years.
It's an Amish log home with a beautiful stain on it and the best back deck you've ever seen in your whole life.
It overlooks pine-forested foothills and an open meadow where deer and coyotes roam. And ever since the pandemic ramped up in mid-March, Phelan has been spending most days up here, away from people. That's because, like a lot of folks in Libby, he's vulnerable to COVID-19. His lungs are scarred from breathing in asbestos-laced dust from a nearby mine for decades.
Feels like somebody's standing on your chest. Or almost like somebody stuffed a pillow down there in your lung.
Phelan is 61 years old, but even climbing up a small hill near his house is hard. He reaches for his inhaler.
Magic stuff. Albuterol. Pound that stuff down.
Phelan says he can manage the symptoms, but he believes his lungs aren't strong enough to fight off COVID-19. So he's staying away from town. He hasn't visited his son and granddaughter in months, and...
Hadn't it been for COVID, my will would not be written. But it is now, and it's filed in the courthouse, and the whole goddamn thing is all done. That gives you some idea how seriously I take this.
A few miles away from Phelan's dream house, Miles Miller sees patients like Phelan every week at a small ranch-style medical center in town.
Our patients having an underlying lung disease would make recovery from COVID-19 more difficult.
Miller has lived in Libby, Montana since 1990. That was the year the vermiculite mine that caused this public health disaster finally closed down. Before that, Miller says, the mine spewed asbestos-laden dust throughout Libby, constantly.
During the heyday, I don't think you could shop for groceries in this town without breathing some of the dust.
And it can take decades for someone to develop health problems from breathing in that dust. Miller says about 1 in 10 residents in the Libby area are currently diagnosed with an asbestos-related disease, which can be anything from scarred lungs to various cancers. But when it comes to COVID, so far the town has been somewhat spared. Miller chalks that up to the community taking the pandemic seriously from the get-go, with widespread testing, contact tracing, and quarantining.
Had we not been very stringent with that, it could have been devastating.
Most people here are resigned to the various restrictions, including masks and social distancing. But for a few, the town's history with the mine and the government's initial inaction has made them wary of authority.
They profiteered off our precious lives and souls.
That's Doug Shaw. His lungs are scarred from asbestos. And during our conversation, he rails against the state government and the mine's owner, W.R. Grace and Company, for covering up the contamination here for decades.
I do not like what they did to us here and allowed to be done to us.
He calls it murder. And that distrust of authority has bled into his reaction to COVID-19. He questions the science and is frustrated by the restrictions.
Nobody has to live like this. We need to get back to work.
That sentiment runs strong throughout Northwest Montana. It's a conservative region with a libertarian streak, and Libby's economy relies on summer visitors. And this has led to a paradox. On one hand, local officials in the community have largely accepted public health guidelines. But on the other, the county is allowing big public events like a rodeo and an international chainsaw competition. Julie Kendall isn't pleased about that.
These people that come to these events from out of town are going to our gas stations, our grocery stores, and they could be exposing you right there.
She's a phlebotomist at the local hospital. She was also diagnosed with an asbestos-related disease a couple of months ago. She figures she got it as a kid from the piles of mine waste next to the local swimming pool. Kendall sees parallels between asbestos and COVID-19.
It's unseen. You don't see it. You can be doing the innocentest thing, and it could still get you.
But Kendall also believes those parallels have given folks like her a leading edge on dealing with this pandemic because they've been here before.
We're already afraid here. So it's kind of like one more shake of the dice. I don't know how else to say that. You can't live every day in fear, but here we do.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie.
When we come back, we will turn our attention to wildlife. Stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
One thing we're proud of here at Wyoming Public Media is our podcasts. Whether you're looking for a good story from human nature,
I was convinced some of them are going to die,
or you want to hear our region in unexpected ways through the modern West.
When women teach women, we're saving relationships one cast at a time.
We've got a whole world waiting for you online. Explore under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Human development can push species out of their native habitats, but people can also help put the species back in. On the Fort Belknap Reservation in Montana, bison and endangered black-footed ferrets have already been reintroduced. Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Engel says they'll try one more.
What you're hearing is a swift fox. They're reddish-brown, a bit smaller than a house cat, with big ears and a long tail. They do their best to sound intimidating when they're live-trapped, but they tend to be quite docile. They were historically found across the Great Plains region, from Alberta, Canada, down through the central part of the United States. But today, they're only in about 40% of that area. Gila Shamoon is a research ecologist with the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute. She says both natural barriers and human development contribute to the species range reduction.
Currently in Montana, we have a small population very close to the border between Montana and Canada. And then there's a pretty big gap before we get down here to Wyoming, where swift fox have already recovered. So there's a gap of about 300 miles between that northern population and the south population, which is from Wyoming all the way down to New Mexico.
The main barrier that keeps them from spreading through Montana, Shamoon says, is the Milk River. But the Assiniboine and Gros Ventre tribes on the Fort Belknap Reservation have partnered with nearly 30 different organizations, including the Smithsonian, to help bridge that gap. They're relocating nearly 200 swift foxes from Wyoming, Colorado, and Kansas to their historic range on the reservation.
This fox used to be a part of this ecosystem. It's a grassland specialist. It's been almost 50 years. It's a native species. It's important to that community as well, the community that's living on Fort Belknap. It's a missing link in this ecosystem.
Shami Anderson is with Defenders of Wildlife, another partner on the project. She says several of the locations where the foxes will be released are home to other reintroduced species.
This is a major effort on behalf of the tribe, as has been all animals they've restored to their lands, including buffalo. They have endangered black-footed ferrets and very healthy prairie dogs that provide for the ferrets as well as other animals. And Belknap is just a model in Native Plains wildlife. They've really done an amazing job.
Tribal Council member Mike Fox says reintroducing species is important to them.
Ever since the Tribal Fish and Game Department was created, we've always looked at restoring things back to their natural habitat as much as we can in a modern world. And so little steps like this is something that we definitely want to continue.
Fox says this will be their last big effort.
It kind of rounds it out. The area that we're going to be focusing on reintroducing them into is Snake Butte Buffalo Pasture, and it's 23,000 acres, that Snake Butte area. It'll be one of the most intact short grass prairie ecosystems in the entire country now.
This year, 40 to 50 foxes are being live-trapped in Albany and Carbon counties in Wyoming. The efforts started earlier this month. Ecologist Hila Shamoon says they'll be given a health check and a GPS collar and then released in Montana.
We put them on top of an empty prairie dog burrow that we expand in the entrance so they can go in. And we're going to leave them there for a period of between 3 to 5 days. Usually they would dig their way out in about 3 days. Sometimes they decide to stay in that pen. So on day 5, we'll just take it down and release them.
Shamoon says a soft release will help reduce the animal's stress and get it acquainted with the landscape before it's set loose on its own. Over the next 5 years, they plan to repeat this process, trapping twice in Colorado, once in Kansas, and again in Wyoming. The 5-year time frame allows them to release multiple age groups on the site. After those 5 years, the foxes will continue to be monitored to make sure the population is healthy and growing. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Ivy Engel.
Grand Teton National Park experienced higher numbers of visitors this summer. Hiking trails saw increased daily traffic, and campgrounds were filling up earlier in the day than previous years. But Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson brings us the story of one park visitor who still managed to find a secluded spot away from the crowds.
It's the end of August, and I've joined a handful of scientists for an expedition in Grand Teton National Park in northwestern Wyoming. The journey starts with a paddle across the north end of Jackson Lake to the mouth of a drainage. From there, we pull in our neoprene socks, extend our trekking poles, and start wading up a creek bed, ankle deep in the cool water, in search of the elusive harlequin duck.
It's a tough species, one of the toughest.
Retired Wyoming game and fish biologist Susan Patla keeps her voice down in an effort to sneak up on the ducks. For close to 20 years, she's monitored Wyoming's harlequin population and worked to protect their summer breeding grounds in the Tetons. Arriving from the Pacific coast, Wyoming is the farthest east the ducks migrate. The drakes are blue and rust-colored, and the hens are golden brown. Both have white markings that help them disappear amidst the turbulent white water and rocks.
Their whole strategy is secrecy.
Predators like peregrine falcons have a hard time seeing the harlequins, and so do we, which is why we're spending hours scanning every last pebble for a sign of the bird.
Do you see it?
No.
Grand Teton National Park biologist Sarah Hegg signals me to stop. I freeze as best I can, standing on loose rocks and rushing water. And she pulls out her binoculars. This is it, a harlequin. No, Hegg says with a chuckle.
It was like a stick, almost looked like a bird head, but.
Hegg has already been out here for 2 days and only counted one brood, that is a hen and her ducklings.
There's a lot of just slow plodding, peeking around the corners. And
seeing ducks like a very, very small percentage of that time.
Chag picks up a rock, hoping for a clue.
What do you got?
I think it's the outer shell of aquatic invertebrate, but must have hatched already.
Tiny aquatic creatures like this one fortify harlequin ducklings before they fly over 800 miles back to their winter homes on the rocky Pacific coast. Several years ago, Haig and Patla worked with the Biodiversity Research Institute and the Grand Teton National Park to implant transmitters on some of the male ducks. Patla says they tracked their movements from 2016 to 2019.
We were afraid maybe this population was so genetically, you know, and just isolated from the other ducks to the point that if they disappeared, there wouldn't be other ducks that might come here. But now we know both their migrations are more widespread, their wintering grounds are a bit more widespread.
They fan themselves out along the coast from central Oregon to northern British Columbia.
Which is great because oil spills on the ocean in the winter would be the biggest threat to, especially if they all wintered in a small area.
Patla says even small populations, like Wyoming's estimated 70 breeding pairs of harlequins, make a big contribution to biodiversity, because it's the more isolated fringe populations that survive catastrophic events.
Whether they be man-caused or climatic. So that's why it's very important to keep as much as the genetic diversity and distribution of these species, because who knows, maybe these will be the pairs that survive, you know.
After a full day of slow and slippery creek exploration, we admit defeat. Not one harlequin sighting. Patla says that's not necessarily a bad thing. For now, the Tetons still provide the secluded habitat that harlequins and lots of other animals need to thrive. As we paddle back across Jackson Lake, we recount all the other amazing birds we saw today.
That western grebe.
We saw sharp-shinned hawk.
Yep.
Carrying prey, yeah.
So it was feeding young still.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson in Grand Teton National Park.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. This show and individual segments will be archived on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can also get the Open Spaces podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. For news stories and other station news, make sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can also send us ideas for future stories on both of those sites. Please support this program and our Wyoming news coverage with a donation today. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.